Coming up on Weekend America.
The Obama campaign spends millions to get its message out, but there are other messages already out there.
He's a Muslim, you understand, and I like Muslims, but he's a wicked one.
On the ground with open microphones in Ohio, I'm John Moe. Campaigning can bring out the worst in people, even in high school.
And here's what I remember people saying. Rob, your brother, he said, my opponent has no experience, he has nothing to run on, and he couldn't do this if he tried.
A regrettable campaign revisited. And a teacher assigns her class to write letters to themselves, promising she'll mail them to the students in 10 years. 37 years later, she finds the letters.
They were yellowed with age. They had a rubber band around them. I sat down. I held them in my hands. I looked at them, and I felt terrible.
We reunite her with a student, and we open a letter on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe, coming to you from downtown St. Paul. Charles Schulz is from St. Paul, and there's all these Peanuts statues all over town. Charlie Brown, Snoopy. Sometimes you walk around a corner, and bam, big fiberglass Linus standing right there. It's kind of crazy. We're bringing you what America is up to this weekend. Race and forgiveness in Michigan. Long forgotten letters from fifth graders found in a trunk in Minnesota. A decaying viaduct in Seattle that people just keep driving on anyway. That viaduct is closed this weekend. So what are people doing? They're out walking on it. What are you doing this weekend?
This weekend, I am going to be shopping for a Halloween costume.
I'll go to the beach if the weather permits.
Probably skateboarding with my friends.
Take my mother for a drive. As long as the wheels are moving, she's happy.
I will probably go to Golden Gate Park and sit in the botanical garden there and read.
This weekend, I'm volunteering in Nevada to get Obama elected.
This weekend, I'm installing lots of tires, gonna hook up a boiler, hang some sheetrock, and go skiing with my kids.
What's amazing is that that guy is going to do all those things at once. The boiler, the sheetrock, the skiing. I'm joking. Those voices came from San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Fairbanks, Alaska. Well, we're getting right down to it. 2 weeks from Tuesday, voters go to the polls. Election day. I know it hasn't been covered in the press very much, but it's really actually happening. I never thought we'd get there back when this campaign started. Seems like it was 40, 50 years ago. Obama and McCain are now hitting the battleground states hard. Every minute counts. And over the last few elections, Ohio seems to be perpetually held up as one of the most important and swingiest of the swing states. Mari Saito from WCPN in Cleveland has been talking with voters around that state for months now. Hello, Mari.
Hi, John.
Where have you been going to talk to voters recently?
We've been talking with voters in the southern and eastern parts of Ohio. These are predominantly white, working class areas. As you know, and as you just said, Ohio is critical if you want to get to the White House. Well, these parts of the state are critical if you want to win Ohio, and that's because they flip. These are people who voted for Bill Clinton, and then they voted for George W. Bush.
As go these parts of Ohio, so go the nation. They get to be the belle of the ball here.
Oh, definitely. You know, Barack Obama was there last week on a jobs tour, followed closely by Sarah Palin and then Joe Biden. I went down the evening of an Obama rally in Portsmouth. This is a town of about 20,000 on the Ohio River. But instead of going to the rally, I walked over to the nearby Kroger's grocery market. In the parking lot, I met people like Michael Thompson. He's a dad of two who works for minimum wage at a local restaurant.
I mean, pretty well, the whole economy around here has gone down the drain. It's been down the drain for years. The only way, like, it would get better if they get somebody in there that can actually do it. But who's going to do that?
At this point, a taxi came to pick up Michael and his wife and kids. And then the cab driver said he wouldn't let them in unless they paid up front.
So did he have money?
You know, I'm not sure, but they really got offended by this. And so they walked home with the baby stroller and a cart half full of groceries.
Is that experience common around there, this experience of not having the money and trying to figure out where to go?
It is. Scioto County has over, this is the county Portsmouth is in, has over 9% unemployment. And it's like that all around this region. I also went over to the local Republican Party office in Portsmouth, where I found volunteer Brenda Willis. She was finishing up a night of calls to potential voters.
A lot of people, what we're hearing is they're asking about the candidate's stances on abortion. They're also certainly, the big one is the economy.
So, you know, if you remember 4 years ago, it seems like an eternity.
Yes.
Voters in Ohio seemed, you know, much more preoccupied with social issues like gay marriage and also the war. Now it is all about the economy. Back in Portsmouth, I met 31-year-old Luke Haywood. He couldn't find a job near his house, so he commutes 40 miles to Kentucky to work as a crane operator.
If I can't feed my family, I don't care if, you know what I mean, I'd like a Martian. If it means feeding my family, you know what I'm saying? I don't care about the race.
Why did he bring up race just then?
Well, you know, I decided to ask people directly about race because it keeps coming up in these coded ways. This whole election cycle, since even before our March primary, reporters in our newsroom have been getting these weird questions about Barack Obama, especially after we turn off the tape recorder. So we stopped turning off the tape recorders, and I have some tape if you want to hear it.
Sure.
He's a Muslim, you understand, and I like Muslims. But he's a wicked one.
I have a hard time with his name, with Osama's name, because of what we're going through and what this country's been through. And maybe that's wrong, but I don't really know of his affiliations because of his name.
Wow. After everything we've heard with this election, they think that Barack Obama is a Muslim and they transpose his name with Osama bin Laden.
To be totally honest with you, comments like this are really hard for me to play. All of us here as Ohio voters, we're not all thinking this. But pollsters do say race works both for and against Obama here. So to get some context, I talked with Deborah Burstyn Donbrier. She's an African-American conservative Republican. And the state party put her in charge of expanding outreach to minorities in Ohio during the 2004 election.
There's a part of you that maybe you want to cry or maybe you want to be upset. And there's another part that says, no, this is exciting. We have to confront all of these things that we didn't want to talk about in polite company. And now we have to deal with these things. And I think that's great.
So this woman was in charge of getting more minorities in Ohio to vote Republican 4 years ago. How's that effort going this time around?
Deborah Burstyn Donbrier doesn't work for the state Republican Party anymore. This year, in what has been an incredibly difficult decision for her, she's voting for Barack Obama.
Mari Saito from WCPN in Cleveland. Mari, thank you.
Thank you, John.
Race will also play a critical role this election cycle in the industrial state of Michigan. In August, the Detroit Free Press and a local television station polled 600 likely Michigan voters. Nearly a third believed that if elected, Barack Obama would try to make up in some way for historical slights against African Americans. Members of Macomb County's Renaissance Unity Church tried to deal with the legacy of racism 8 years ago. During a Sunday service, their minister, who was white, asked white members of the church to apologize to black members in a ceremony of forgiveness. The church has had several ministers since then, but as they attend church this weekend, parishioners say they'll never forget the impact of that moment.
Let the words of my
name is Maureen McDonald. I'm 58 years old. I'm white, and I'm a freelance writer. When the minister asked all of the African American people in the room to stand up and for the whites to stay seated, the degree of discomfort, anxiety, fear was just rampant in the room. You could feel the little twitchies going through your body, like, what's it going to do to us? I don't want to participate in this. I came to just get a nice spiritual uplift. Then she asked white people to stand up and stare directly into the eyes of an African-American person. I found myself staring in the eyes of a very beautiful woman who was probably in my age group. As I tried to make eye contact with her, she kind of looked at me like, I don't know who you are. I don't know what you're about, but I don't particularly like you looking at me like that. And I don't like looking at you like that. And as I kept looking, I started finding maybe I hadn't really been looking in a long time. And then the minister had us read this prayer.
To the African American of the United States, for what has been done to hurt you and offend you, for the evils of racism throughout our history, please forgive me and please forgive this country.
My name is Gary Madden. I'm 66 years old. I'm white. I worked 34 years for the Detroit Public Schools. I became an adult during the 60s when there was a lot of social upheaval. I kind of decided to go to to Detroit because of a sort of a missionary zeal to sort of heal some of the social injuries that I saw as an adult, a young adult. So at that particular day, I remember her telling us to turn to the nearest African-American person. My wife is African-American. And so I turned to her and spoke to her, you know.
On behalf of my nation, I deeply apologize. If I could rewrite history, I would, but I cannot.
That was a powerful Sunday.
I acknowledge now the genius of your people.
I am Shirley Tolbert Madden, and I worked with Detroit Public Schools for over 34 years.
May the demon of racism be cast off.
My husband, who is white, we stood up and we were being guided by the minister to say certain things.
May the spirit of this amends bring peace to your soul. Truly, you have waited long.
You know, I felt awkward because I felt some resentment for it. You know, I had, in my book, done about as much as a person can do.
I have looked into his eyes many, many times, but this time was different. It was an emotional tone as he spoke, and I can't even explain the impact that that had with me. Even though it was an individual saying this, it still felt as though it was coming from the race, the white race saying to me, forgive me. And then for me to say, I forgive the white race for the things that were done.
It didn't last very long. We sat back down and I began to think about the experience. I thought, you know, this is really what the country needs to do and should have done a long time ago.
I don't know that America's ready for that yet. My name is Lynn Behrens Hanna. I'm 53 years old. I am a white female, a registered nurse by trade. My heart is open when I look at my son, who is 17. They don't think about people's color. They don't think about it at all. They're more concerned where they're going to go to college, or did they play Guitar Hero today, or the latest video game. Should we apologize? Yeah. It's like when you forgive. It's not for you. It's to help me heal.
May the future be made new. May the pain of the past be gone forever.
Eldora Stevens, age 66, race African American. At this time in history, I think there is definitely a need for forgiveness and for an apology to be given to our race, because so many people are harboring negative feelings toward anybody that's different from them. I think that we need to dig deeper into ourselves and find that place where we can forgive. Many of us, I think, are stuck, and we need to get past it.
Weekend America's Desiree Cooper brought us those voices from Renaissance Unity, a church outside Detroit. You can read more comments from parishioners at our website. The prayer at that service is called Amends to the African American and was written by Marianne Williamson. She was the minister of Renaissance Unity in 2000 when this service and this apology took place. Learn more at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Obama and McCain debate, and they really care a lot about you, provided you are this one plumber from Ohio. Good news, bad news, no news, next on Weekend America. It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Another busy week in the news. In fact, when's the last time there was a slow, boring week? Maybe we could use one of those, actually. Events around the world are sometimes hard to make sense of unless you have a panel of guests at your disposal who are able to sort it all into three handy categories of good news, bad news, or no news. Fortunately, we have just such a panel. Carrie Howley is from Reason Magazine, where she's a contributing editor. Hi, Carrie.
Hello.
From Harper's Magazine, Ken Silverstein. Hey, Ken.
Hi.
And former NPR reporter and Seattle radio show host Luke Burbank. Hello, Luke.
Hi, John. Please, could you call me Luke the Welder?
Luke the Welder. Okay, good. First topic, the third and final debate of the presidential campaign took place on Wednesday night in New York State. John McCain and Barack Obama sparred over tax policy, negative campaigning, and health care plans. In terms of helping the American people make up their minds about who to vote for on November 4th, was this debate good news, bad news, or no news?
I think it has to be considered bad news because if you think about what's supposed to be happening here, it's supposed to be a chance for these people to come together, to make their point, to have some kind of conversation with each other. But they're so non-spontaneous and the rules are always so bizarre that basically the winner is the person who just best memorizes their sales pitch and doesn't overtly pick their nose.
I agree with Luke. It was just sort of depressing to watch these guys stand out there and go through pretty much the same talking points that they'd gone through the first two debates. Just once, I'd love to hear something really out of the blue, even if it was just, you know, what's your favorite dish at IHOP? I mean, do you like pigs in the blanket? Anything just to get them off the talking points.
I think along those lines, the final debate has to be good news, chiefly because of the qualifier final. I mean, I can't actually remember a time before this electoral campaign, but I'm sure that, you know, we as a people can find ways to spend our time that don't involve drinking everyone every time someone says Maverick. And I anticipate this enormous cultural flowering when voters stop pouring their creative energy into composing like pro-Obama epic poetry. It'll be another golden age.
It was rehearsed, but there was a lot of policy mixed in with all the platitudes. And there was a differentiation between what the two guys believed, even if they spent a lot of time kind of jabbing at each other.
I just think it's the worst possible way to try to get a read on these people, because if somebody's nervous and they're sweating, or if they lose their mind and start talking about a random plumber, you know, you take something away from this debate, which may or may not really mean anything about their fitness to be commander in chief.
Well, now, how about the fact that I couldn't leave my house on Thursday morning without 10 people making Joe the Plumber jokes? What kind of news was the Joe the Plumber dominance?
Probably reflects the fact that there was so little else going on at the debate.
I don't know. I find him strangely likable in a belligerent sort of way. And I felt kind of bad for him, given I doubt that he had decided to become the hallmark of this exchange between, you know, two men, one of which is about to become the most powerful human being on Earth. It seems silly and a little unfair to him.
Moving on. Gas prices continued to drop around the country this week. A gallon of unleaded was at $3.04 in terms of the national average on Friday. That's down more than 80 cents from a month ago and over a dollar from July. Meanwhile, a barrel of oil was at around $71. Decreased demand is given some credit, probably brought on by the worldwide economic struggles. Lower fuel prices. Good news, bad news, or no news?
I'm going to go with no news. Markets fluctuate. Oil prices fluctuate a lot because demand is inelastic. But there really is an amazing fixation on gas prices in this country. I mean, all commodity prices rise and fall. But somehow it's only high gas prices that are treated with the sense of apocalyptic foreboding.
We don't go to a station and fill our cars with wheat.
Exactly. You have to wonder if this springs just from the fact that you have nothing else to do while you're pumping gas than to stare at this ominous rolling price indicator and start, like, hating on Hugo Chavez. I mean, maybe if you had to stand in front of rolling milk prices for 5 long minutes, that's what we'd freak out about.
Given there's so little good news out there, though, I guess let me just opt for the good news. You know, when I fill up the car and at the end of the process, you're looking at an receipt for $80. It is mildly terrifying. So even though it's a sign of the weak economy, it, I don't know, makes me feel just a little bit better when I'm not stunned at the end of filling the gas tank.
I think it's clearly great news. Where I live in the Seattle area, some of the best bread lines are actually in the suburbs, and those are a long drive. And so this really kind of helps me with that. I feel like it's bad news and it frustrates me. Somebody like me who lives in the middle of a city and has a tiny car, I maybe relatively small carbon footprint, it's kind of frustrating because that was something that made me feel really good, was driving past these enormous cars and just thinking to myself, my car could fit inside that car and I'm such a better human being. And now I don't have that smugness in my life for at least a couple weeks, and that for me is a great loss.
Wow. You started with environmentalism there and then brought it around to self-serving really, really quickly.
Well, revenge and vanity are the two guiding forces in my life.
Okay, good to
know.
So
I guess this hurts me on the revenge front.
So it's letting people off the hook is what you're saying.
Yeah, totally.
First of all, I just need to say that I don't own a car and only bike everywhere, and therefore I win the smugness challenge no matter what the price of gas.
Congratulations, Carrie.
Thank you. Thanks, yeah.
You've bested me this time, Howley.
All right, finally, last topic. We are in the midst of an economic crisis, the likes of which hasn't been seen since the Depression. We are fighting two wars. We are trying to decide on a president, and the number one movie in America for 2 weeks in a row was Beverly Hills Chihuahua. It's received terrible reviews. It's about talking dogs. I want to think for a moment about how this reflects on culture and society. Is this movie's success good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, I haven't seen Beverly Hills Chihuahua, which is clearly humiliating in terms of cultural literacy. But I have to say that based on the previews, I think it's bad news. It perpetuates stereotypes about Chihuahuas, not all of whom you may have noticed have Mexican accents. And it also perpetuates the disturbing myth that Chihuahuas are cute. They're not cute. They're rodent-like in appearance.
Well, I haven't seen Beverly Hills Chihuahua either, but I have to dispute based on my son's review of the movie. He's 8, and he assures me it is one of the great movies of the modern era. So I don't want to endorse the idea that it's a really bad movie.
It doesn't reflect badly on society, on the dumbing down of our culture?
I don't think it means we're getting any dumber. We're probably just sort of, we've plateaued. I mean, we're, you know.
I think it's good news. I mean, to all the cynics out there, even some people on this radio show, I just think what you're missing is that these are dogs that we're talking about here. Dogs traditionally almost never are able to speak in a human voice. I mean, just to have your mind grapes expanded like that, I think, is something we should all probably take a minute to do.
It's true. Challenging stereotypes is a good thing. It's always good to challenge your prejudices.
That's the news of this week. Thankfully, now it all makes sense. Panel, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
See, that's what public radio is all about, expanding your mind grapes. Carrie Howley is a contributing editor to Reason Magazine. Ken Silverstein is Washington editor for Harper's Magazine and author of Turkmenistan. Luke Burbank is a former NPR reporter. He hosts the radio show Too Beautiful to Live in Seattle.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Attack ads, dirty tricks, an urge for power so overwhelming it overtakes personal dignity. Hey, no one said high school was easy. Ahead on Weekend America. Thank you. It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. In the coming months, we're going to be looking at the state of America's infrastructure on this show. A couple of weeks ago, we asked you to tell us about the aging bridges, highways, buildings in your towns and how they're affecting your lives. And a bunch of you wrote in about the Alaskan Way Viaduct in Seattle. Some people said it was in such bad shape they would never drive on it. The viaduct is a traffic artery a couple miles long that runs along the waterfront. Concrete, elevated, two levels, 55 years old. I'm joined by Ron Ponenen, and he's the Deputy Corridors Director for the Washington State Department of Transportation. Ron, where are you right now?
So I'm standing on the upper deck of the viaduct. We have the road closed this weekend for semi-annual inspection and maintenance work.
And what's the scene right now? Who's up there with you?
Well, we take, in addition to taking the opportunity to do a lot of maintenance work over a two-day period, we do public tours of the viaduct. We bring about 140 people out here, set up some stations. We have project people talk to them about what's going on, what our concerns are with the viaduct, and the plans for its replacement.
So what kind of shape is it in?
It's in, generally, I would say, fair condition for a structure of its age. Our concern is in a couple of areas. One, it's seismic vulnerability. It sits on soil that is liquefiable, meaning the soil would turn to jello in an earthquake. The seawall, which runs next to the viaduct, is vulnerable as well. It's in poor condition, due largely to marine borers, which eat the wood. And then the viaduct has load restrictions on it just because of its basic design.
Now, I remember these marine borers from when I lived in Seattle and drove on the viaduct quite a bit. These are the gribbles, right?
These are the gribbles, and I'm holding right now a piece of wood that was taken from the seawall, and if it's probably about a foot long, but it's full of holes. And if you imagine a piece of wood that looks like Swiss cheese, that's what the gribbles do to wood in a marine environment.
And that's what people are driving on right now. Well, what are the risks of this structure in terms of its health and stability and safety?
Well, on a day-to-day basis, it's safe to use. That's why we inspect it four times a year. We close it twice a year for maintenance work and thorough inspection. Its real vulnerability is to the next earthquake, and we have no way of knowing when that'll happen. The 2001 earthquake was a wake-up call for us. Our structural engineers tell us if the earthquake had lasted 15 seconds longer, we probably would have seen parts of the viaduct collapse. Hmm. So we have a real urgency in replacing this structure. We have a plan for the Southern Mile, and of course the big debate in Seattle is what to do with the mile that runs along the central waterfront.
Well, that earthquake that you talked about was, more than 7 years ago now. Why hasn't something been done about this?
Well, this is a very major project and means a lot both to the state and the city. It's going to be, in the end, $3 billion worth of work. It's a chance to do something different with Seattle's waterfront. And so although we do want to replace it, we're taking a good thorough look at ways that we could do it and allow it to be more than just a transportation project. But I do want to mention that although it's been 7 years, we are starting utility work that's necessary to remove the viaduct. There's a lot of utilities in the corridor, and we'll start the work on the south end next year where we have agreement on the Southern Mile.
Is this typical of other projects and other structures around the country? Are there other Alaskan Way viaducts around the country in similar conditions?
There are tens of thousands of bridges nationwide. In Washington, the state DOT owns about 3,600 bridges, and there are two that we are most concerned about, and they're two of our biggest structures, the Alaskan Way Viaduct and the SR 520 floating bridge. Both mega projects, both bridges that were built in the late or the 50s or the early 60s, and really have come to the end of their useful life. And there are literally tens of thousands of bridges around the country that will be coming due in the next couple decades.
Well, Ron Ponenen of the Washington State Department of Transportation, good luck to you, good luck to Seattle, and watch out for gribbles.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Okay, let's have a little fun. If you've been following the economic crisis, you know things are chaotic and unstable right now. Obviously, this makes it an ideal time for a supervillain to take over the world. I'm joined by supervillain Dr. Cruelty. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, John.
Dr. Cruelty, everything seems lined up for you to finally take over, yet you haven't made your move. Why is that?
It's crazy, isn't it? You know, this is the thing I have been waiting for my whole life. All right. Problem is, there's no capital available to make that conquest happen. If the credit markets are frozen, I can't pay scientists to build my death ray. And I can't get the factories going to build my robot army. There's no lasers. It's ridiculous.
And that's important because...
Cowering, John. Cowering is a crucial factor in my industry. How do I get billions of people to cower before me without a death ray or a robot army? No cower, no power, John, I always say. And look, whoever takes over this mess, whether it's me or Lord Sinister or the evil Phantom, even the IMF, they're going to have to stabilize things. No, thank you, right? I'm evil, but I'm not crazy. I'm a little crazy.
Well, forgive me for this, Dr. Cruelty, but you're a villain. You're not tied to the traditional economy like the rest of us are. Can't you just break into the banks and take the money?
That's the problem, John. There is no money. There's no such thing as money anymore. There's just this idea of money. It's debt being transferred and sold, bailouts, speculation. You can't build a robot army with transferred debt. You can't break in to the index of leading economic indicators. There's nothing to break into.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make you upset. I mean, so you go into a period of retrenchment, I suppose, professionally, and you still have your dozens of henchmen in matching jumpsuits, right?
Not really. We've had a few layoffs. Three guys I've got left.
Three henchmen.
Part-time.
Still, you always have the skull-shaped mountain hideout, though, right?
For now, yeah,
no,
hopefully.
No, don't tell me.
I bought it with a subprime mortgage, John, and they're foreclosing. I had this scheme, okay? I was going to steal from Lehman Brothers, Wachovia, and Washington Mutual. It was the perfect plan. These are financial institutions. They're banks. Oh, God.
Dr. Cruelty, best of luck to you.
Thank you, John.
Of course, there's the other way of coming to power. Also, votes instead of death rays could work, I guess. Many expected Barack Obama and John McCain to run campaigns that were more civil and issues-based than those in recent elections. It didn't really happen. When votes are at stake, elbows and negative ads fly. Weekend America's Charlie Schroeder has been watching some of those negative ads. For him, they're a little traumatic because they take him right back to high school.
This is the story about me and a high school classmate of mine named Dave. Dave won't talk for this story, and I totally understand why. You see, when I was in high school, we both ran for vice president of our class, and in my campaign, I went negative. Why did I do that? Well, maybe the best way to answer that is to tell you a little bit about who I was in high school.
You were Mr. Peepers.
That's my mom. Whenever we talk about my high school days, she calls me Mr. Peepers. Apparently, Mr. Peepers was some sort of character from the 1950s.
Then Mr. Peepers wore these little big round tortoiseshell glasses and a bow tie, and that's who you were in high school. Yep.
And all this in the heart of rural Pennsylvania. Amish country, to be exact. I went to high school in the late 80s, and while most of my peers had mullets and wore Guns N' Roses t-shirts, I was a living, breathing Alex P. Keaton. Seersucker suit, bow tie, and all.
Yeah, you were like young government person and Mr. Republican, and you wanted to be president.
Which means I had to start in student government.
I remember making a reference in my speech to the fundraising of Wolfgang Candy.
What does that mean?
Well, that's what we sold our sophomore year.
Oh,
we made buku bucks.
That's my class president, Nate Althaus. During our freshman and sophomore years, I was his vice president.
We were talking about having a class trip to Hawaii at that point.
Oh, right. We were going to take the entire class and go to Hawaii.
Yeah, and then we ended up spending $20,000 on the prom, so that went pork.
We really are the government. we don't know how to spend money. We like allocate it and like for all the wrong things. For our freshman and sophomore elections, we didn't have to give speeches. I just threw my name in a hat for vice president and was elected. But for our junior year, one of our teachers had this brilliant idea that the candidates should address the class. You know, podium, auditorium, bunting.
The people in the audience were thrilled. They were elated at the fact that they did not have to go to class. This was an
hour. Sure, sure.
This was an assembly during class time.
So, who was Dave? Well, he was kind of the class clown, or the runner-up to the class clown. He wasn't active in student government. He hung out with kids who smoked who knows what before school. He always wore this oversized army jacket. People called him Alf because he had a tuft of hair that stuck up on top of his head. My memory of his speech is a little hazy, but Nate's is better.
When he spoke, it seemed like he was out of his element a little bit, and the audience, even though he might have struggled through parts of his speech, respected the fact that he had taken the chance and gone up against a political juggernaut such as yourself.
I wrote my speech on a piece of notebook paper.
And here's what I remember people saying.
Right. That's my brother, Rob. He wasn't even in the audience, but people told him what I did.
Rob, your brother. He said, my opponent has no experience, he has nothing to run on, and he couldn't do this if he tried.
Which doesn't really sound all that bad, but it was. You see, I delivered those words with so much venom that my jowls went into spasms. Halfway through my speech, kids started booing me. Even Nate couldn't believe that I was picking on poor Dave.
I remember folding my arms and rubbing my eyes, thinking, why?
I was shocked. I'd seen Ronald Reagan and Walter Mondale say much worse things to each other, and nobody seemed to care.
The mistake you made in going negative was that all of you lived together, worked together, knew one another.
That's Larry Sabato. He's the director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia, and the man who the Wall Street Journal called the most quoted college professor in the land. So, naturally, I trust him. Sabato tells me that imitating presidential politics in a so-called group environment is a recipe for disaster.
The humility route would have been much more appropriate, much more
right.
effective. But with the anonymity that comes with a large electorate of a
uh-huh.
state or a nation, also comes the ability to go on the attack, because people will believe almost anything about candidates they do not know.
But I wasn't anonymous, because in high school, everyone pretty much knows everyone. Class president, Nate Althaus.
Most people knew you and knew you as a grounded, venerable guy. But for those who might not have been as familiar with you as your inner circle,
mm-hmm.
hearing that from you and considering the image you had of being this kind of preppy, educated, worldly scholar, it probably shifted those people to thinking, this guy is... He's obnoxious.
Yeah. After my speech, I went to health class where the future salutatorian practically spit on me. I lost friends. Dave gained many. For the next couple weeks, I repeatedly apologized to anyone who'd speak to me and tried to regain my classmates' confidence. Later, when the election results were announced over the PA system, I was shocked and relieved. I'd won. Again, Larry Sabato.
People are willing to forgive family and friends almost anything. They know them fairly well. And you had time to make up that lost ground. You had time to personally apologize. Look, in a broader electorate, apology ads work. Sometimes
right.
Candidates who've been in deep trouble come on and say, I screwed up. I'm sorry. I hope you'll forgive me. Well, most people say yes.
After graduation, I retired from politics. What did the election do for Dave? No telling. When Dave's MySpace page loads, this song plays. He doesn't log in for months at a time, and doesn't respond to me. His friends tell me that they lose track of him. They worry about his health. He's a proud father of three. His hometown is listed as The Road. While I was goofing off in college, Dave was doing something I always thought I'd do, serving our country. Now Dave's a disabled Gulf War vet. He can't walk more than a block or two without the aid of a wheelchair. He writes that the government should come clean about Gulf War syndrome. A few years ago, he went back to college and got an associate's degree in history. While he was there, he was active in student government. Me, well, I gave my bow ties to Goodwill a long time ago, but I still own a pair of seersucker pants that I wear every now and then to remind myself of who I once was, a clueless high school student who thought money and power was everything. I'm Charlie Schroeder for Weekend America.
We have pictures from Charlie's high school yearbook. He's smiling in them. WeekendAmerica.org. Well, if you're a fan of wind and rain, and gosh, who isn't really, if we're going to be honest, today is your day. The East Coast, the Midwest, the South, wind and rain everywhere. But there's fun to be had all over the country regardless. Here's Jeannie Yandel.
Neurosurgery, splitting an atom, and working with red-hot metal. All these skills seem really hard to learn in a festival setting, but Fitchburg, Massachusetts proves anyone can learn at least that last one during the Forge In Blacksmithing Festival. 52 and Sunny for blacksmith contests, and totally lily-livered in comparison-seeming pumpkin carving contests. Also antique dealers, auctions, and food. Perhaps barbecue prepared with hammers and anvils. Do you remember that one Thanksgiving where you loved the sweet potatoes so much you ate them until you got sick? Okay, maybe that's just me, whatever. But imagine that whole feeling overtaking a whole town and you'll understand Gilmer, Texas's Yamboree. Sunny in 76 for the Yamboree Queen Coronation and Parade, yam-inspired photography, and decorated yam contest. Next week, don't miss Gilmer's Dear Lord, We're So Sick of Yams Already Festival. Common sense might suggest not climbing on animals bigger than you, but Jamestown, North Dakota throws caution to the wind during Bullarama. Try really hard not to fall off a bull, then if you can still walk, shimmy the night away at the dirt dances. 70 and sunny, an ideal climate for kids to climb into the Greased Pig Wrestling Pit. Less popular is the Help Restore Greased Pig's Dignity Symposium. For more information on these and other events, go to WeekendAmerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
What if you open up your mailbox one day to find a letter from the fifth grade version of yourself? A letter that took 38 years to arrive, next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This weekend, the 1970 fifth grade class at Sunset Elementary School in Bellevue, Washington, is having a reunion. Kind of unusual for a fifth grade class to have a reunion, right? Well, the reason they're getting back together 38 years later, is an old class assignment. In 1970, teacher Kathy Burns Rosen assigned her students to write a letter describing what they thought would be the most important thing to happen in the 70s or 80s. They self-addressed the envelopes, and Kathy promised to mail the letters back to them in 1980. She ended up not teaching after that one year and moved away from Bellevue, and she took the letters with her.
I made a stop at my parents' home in Mankato, Minnesota,
and they were put in a trunk in the attic with all of my college things and teaching things. And I went on my way, you know, with the rest of my life. And that's where they stayed.
Until when?
Until about a year ago. I was home and I was going through some things in the attic and I saw the trunk and I thought, well, let me see what's in there. And I opened it and right on top were those letters. They were yellowed with age. They had a rubber band around them. And it really caught me off guard. I was just taken aback. I sat down. I held them in my hands. I looked at them and I felt terrible. And I said, oh my gosh, what have I done? I've let these kids down. I unfortunately forgot about this assignment for good reasons. I understand that. But I was really heartsick about it, quite honestly, and didn't quite know how to proceed with returning them.
Well, how have you done? How many students have you been able to track down?
I've tracked down all but two of them.
Wow.
Every single one except two of them.
I want to ask you about one student in particular. What kind of student was Julie Jensen?
She was a happy-go-lucky little girl who always had a smile on her face, very, very bright and energetic, loved school.
Well, Julie Jensen is with us from her home in Washington State. Julie, welcome.
Thank you.
And Julie, you're holding your letter right there.
I sure am.
Do you remember this assignment?
No.
Really?
Mm-mm.
Well, what do you remember from the class?
I remember learning about a lot of what was going on in society. I mean, Vietnam War was the big, big, big thing. And it was something that every child brought home to their families to discuss around the dinner table. You know, there were a lot of big things going on. As far as a letter like this, it would have been another assignment.
Well, Julie, you have the letter in your hand. Can you open it, please? You're laughing.
Yes. It says, Julie J., 1970. Shall I read it?
Please. Wait. Kathy, are you ready?
Oh, I'm ready. I can't wait.
Okay. I'm sorry. Here, I'll get myself together here. In 1970, there will be boys with long hair and girls with short hair. The styles of clothes will be short skirts, 10-inch high heels, and 4 inches across. There will hardly be any dresses. That is my letter.
Now, talk about profound.
So was I into fashion or what?
So it's just a description of the fashions of 1970? There's nothing about the future or the 70s or the 80s?
No.
Well, it's kind of an ideal homework assignment when you think about it, because ain't nobody going to grade it for forever.
You know? There you go, yeah.
Yes, and I didn't have to grade it.
Right. It was all sealed up.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Isn't that, Kathy, what do you think?
I think it's great, and I think it's so typical. And really, Julie, you'd be surprised because some of the other girls certainly talked about fashion.
Really?
They did. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
What have you been hearing about the other letters that people have been opening, Kathy?
It was interesting. The war, space exploration, fashion. There was another one about hair and skirts and bell bottoms.
This was a few months after the moon landing, too.
Yes, it was. The moon landing was in July of 69.
Right.
The summer before school started.
John, I think part of the motivation for my note, now that I think a little bit more about it, was Twiggy.
Twiggy? Explain. Mm-hmm.
The movie star, Twiggy.
Right. Very thin model movie star. So so people were landing on the moon and you were thinking about Twiggy.
Can you believe that? Yeah.
Okay, so Kathy, you're the teacher here, or you're the former teacher here. Help us learn the lesson from this project.
I think for me personally, the lesson is that life is full of wonderful surprises and incredible gifts. And this has been one of the most meaningful gifts I've ever, ever had in my life. I never, ever thought when I looked at those letters after I first found them over a year ago that I would ever find these kids. It consumed me for months. I just couldn't wait to get in touch with these kids, to know how they were, and I couldn't wait to see them. And in fact, I am going to see them.
Teacher Kathy Burns-Rosen and student Julie Jensen are attending a reunion of Sunset Elementary's fifth grade class of 1970 tonight in Bellevue, Washington. Two students still haven't been located, Jeff Holman and Kenny Henderson. If you're listening, they're hoping you show up. They have your letters. And for that matter, Miss Brimhall from Nautilus Elementary, my fifth grade teacher, if you're out there, give me a call as well. That's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Rob Byers, Desiree Cooper, who's taking her daughter to see The Secret Life of Bees this weekend, Hillary Frank, Sam Keenan playing music for the zombie pub crawl this weekend, whatever that is, Michael Raphael, Chrissy Clark, Michael May, Brendan Newnham, Ocean Kalen, Sasha Aslanian, Ariel Kitch, Angela Kim, Mark Sanchez, and Chris Wieg. Our theme music was created by Galactic. Special thanks to David Gehrman as Dr. Cruelty and Jim Gates for some production help. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program from our website, weekendamerica.org. Here's a joke for you. Two atoms walk out of a bar. One turns to the other, says, "I think I left my electrons back there." The other atom says, "Are you sure about that?" "Yeah, I'm positive." If you have any better jokes, send them along to me, will you? I'm John Moe. Bye now.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul. And made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
The weekend is the perfect time to sit back and reflect.
There is some kind of sense of isolation and desolation that makes it like a dream moving around in some of these landscapes.
Look, traveling all across this nation can get expensive. Let us do it for you. I'm John Moe, host of Weekend America. Every week we take you across the country and show you what your friends and neighbors are doing and thinking. Join us.